Hello, everyone. Actually, as it turns out, a lot of what I'm going to say is sort of repeating a lot of the stuff that we've already heard, which is probably not a bad thing, because I think it actually reinforces a lot of the messages that are coming across already and will help, I think, prompt more discussion. And I just want to point out, I've put John Wynarski's name on the talk as well, because as it happens, he wrote some work on climate change adaptation in the NT just before he left, and I've borrowed heavily from it. Not going to dwell on this because Lee, I believe, will cover it. But of course, there's many drivers in government and policy. Policies are the key ones. And there's some very strong drivers in the NT, Territory 2030 being this, probably the most powerful. And all of these have some greenhouse or climate change relevance. Territory 2030, for example, has some specific ones, but it also has a pretty big aspirational statement there about no deterioration in the health of biodiversity in the Northern Territory. There is actually a climate change policy which has a whole lot of targets, and again, I won't dwell on them, other than to point out that it has some pretty interesting ones and some quite specific ones, such as using carbon offset markets to reduce the emissions from savanna burning by 500,000 tonnes per year. So they're, you know, already quite targeted and focused activities. But the key one that I'm going to enlarge on a bit is that there's actually in preparation at the moment a climate change adaptation strategy for the NT, a government strategy, which covers a whole lot of areas and a whole lot of sectors, and I'll just talk about the biodiversity one specifically, but there's many obviously cross-cutting issues about there between social, economic and environmental aspects that the government has to consider. So just to step back and I guess reiterate what we've talked about a bit. Talking about adaptation is quite tricky if you don't know exactly what it is you're adapting to, and of course the climate models are very still, at least many of the predictions are still very broad. So an example up there. So we know quite reasonably powerfully that it's going to warm, but we know far less about exactly what's going to happen to the rainfall. So if you look at, I mean, a prediction of a change of minus to plus 10% in the north and minus 40 to plus 15% in the south, it's sort of quite a hard basis to actually to base adaptation strategies on. A second point, which is quite relevant, particularly to what Steve was talking about in the examples, great examples from Queensland, is, of course, as the slide demonstrates, that NT is generally a land of sweeping plains rather than rugged mountain ranges, which means that, you know, the context of how climate change is going to affect species, for example, is quite different. And I found a fantastic bit of Wynarskiism. The territory is somewhat lucky in not supporting terminus or baroquely structured climates. And I think that's the sort of examples that Steve was talking about.
Wynarski sent me an email this morning and he was writing exactly that sort of thing.
Baroquely structured climates.
And so, and do you have a thesaurus?
But the key point, of course, is that we're not, on the whole, talking about, you know, species with incredibly narrow climate ranges sitting on the sides of mountains in cloud forests that are going to disappear entirely in the next 20 years. Obviously, though, however, and as we all know and experience every year as the seasons change, climate is a massively important driver of so much of the ecology of the Northern Territory in many aspects, and both in the north and the south of the territory. And I guess, I mean, that's sort of self-evident. And I guess this is reinforcing what was just being talked about, of course, is that in those sort of contexts, we do really need to consider that the most serious climate change impacts may be through exacerbating existing threats. You know, that it's not some novel thing that we're going to have to deal with in terms of a temperature rise actually physiologically affecting species X. It's just that all these things are currently being wiped out by inappropriate fire regimes, and that climate change is only going to exacerbate that problem. So what we've started to do in the climate adaptation strategy is just to try and summarise what we think the most likely effects of various aspects of climate change are on biodiversity. And I won't go through all of these in detail, but and there's a bit more of a summary at the end. But, for example, if we know that temperature is going to rise, then it's going to have... We can predict that it's going to have various negative impacts on biodiversity that range from the sort of general landscape scale ones. An increased incidence and impact of fire is a pretty much a certain, I would have thought. Through to some quite specific ones, you know. So if you've got reptiles with temperature dependence, sex determination, then obviously a change in ambient temperatures is likely to affect their ecology. And this question about do we have species where they're living close to their thermodynamic thresholds already, so they will be directly affected by temperature change. And maybe it's the exception to the not rugged mountain ranges is actually the ranges in central Australia, where we do have a few species actually perched within a narrow climate envelope. In terms of rainfall changes, of course, the rainfall changes are much more unpredictable, but we think they're going to be, at least the severity of rainfall events is going to change, and the variability of rainfall is going to change. And again, that's likely to have a severe impact through effects on fire regime. It may be that dry seasons become longer and therefore there's longer moisture stress on species in the top end. It certainly appears to be likely to have an effect in central Australia in that, you know, there is going to be a decline in water sources and in their persistence over time. And if those are key refuges in the landscape, then that's clearly going to have some quite dramatic effects on a whole lot of species. And then there might be some other quite obscure ones in the sense that, you know, if rainfall events become more extreme and rivers become more turbid, then, you know, we might actually have serious impacts on seagrass meadows through sediment deposition. Sea level rise, I mean, obviously... The most clearly obvious one is that is a decline or total loss of many of our floodplain environments in the top end. And this is actually one where the interface between sort of biological effects and social effects is really sharp, or it's obviously extremely important, because, you know, we might think that we can't do anything about sea level rise and therefore in terms of the triage thing, we basically have to give up on the floodplains because it only takes a change of 50 centimetres to wipe out half the area of the floodplains in the top end. But of course, socially and culturally and economically, those are just massively important environments for all, you know, for a whole range of people, including for a large amount of the Indigenous population. And so, you know, we're probably not going to be allowed to just write them off as a dead loss. And there's a few other ones up there. And there's a few other obvious things that could have an impact apart from the, you know, the sea level rise, temperature and rainfall, such as, you know, cyclones appear to be quite an important structuring influence disturbance factor in quite a few environments in the far north. CO2 levels might have all sorts of implications, for example, for coral reefs, which don't have the prominence that they do in the Great Barrier Reef, but are still very important environments up here. And, you know, there's going to be likely to be some windless rainforests look like they're likely to be, if they're not destroyed by fire, likely to be winners from other aspects of climate change. So basically, if we put all those together, and, you know, this is obviously your work in progress and will be hopefully, or well, I'm sure it will be informed by, you know, expanding knowledge. This is what we think at the moment, the major risks, and that's sort of combining them into the looking at both the likelihood that they'll occur and the severity of the change, is that, in fact, there's two that are... There's two that are sort of these landscape scale threat-based things which are already happening. So increased impacts from fire and increased impacts from, or potentially new impacts from a whole lot of introduced things, particularly weeds probably, but maybe also diseases or other pest animals. And then there's ones that I guess are more directly related to climate change itself, if I can put it that way. The loss of or decline of water-dependent ecosystems in Central Australia, a loss of continuity or persistence in water bodies, the floodplain environments I mentioned, the montane species in Central Australia, coral reef communities. So briefly, in terms of adaptation, I mean, that's the next step. It's one thing to sort of plan out what the risks are. The adaptation is actually the really hard thing, as we all know. And this is probably the key one, I think. And it's, again, it's an area that we've already talked about, and Andrew was talking about it just before I got up here, is actually maybe the most important thing we can do is make sure that we maximise the resilience of the landscape to climate change, so that in relation to these, you know, these increased risks and pressures, we just make sure that we're managing the landscape as best we can to cope with that. But that probably actually means, it means a lot of things, but it means being very targeted. I mean, part of maximising the resilience is obviously to actually target very carefully where we do that, recognising that we can't do that everywhere in the landscape. So being very sure about where our most important and likely to be impacted areas are in terms of biodiversity, for example, and being fairly sure about what the most likely threats are. This one, I guess, is more about to do with what the sort of things that we still need to know a lot more about, particularly from a government perspective. Obviously, this is the key word, is the cost effectiveness of adaptation strategies, and it can only be informed by good knowledge. So we've already talked about some of these things, actually identifying quite clearly and what the most climate change susceptible species and environments are. Do we have to start thinking about, you know, rescue options, even in the NT context, through translocation or even captive populations? If we're thinking that, for example, weeds are going to be an increasingly key issue, then, you know, making sure that we know where that impacts are most likely to occur. And there's a few others. Obviously, you know, we need to make sure that we've got the capability to actually keep track of what's going on in terms of changes. We need to make sure that the community's got total buy-in to the whole issue, so that there's political support, etc., etc. And also, this is an interesting one, and relates back to Stephen's picture at the start of his talk. If Australia, and particularly the NT, is one of the most secure environments, what role do we actually have as a haven potentially for species and communities from elsewhere? Which is an issue that can't be ignored. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Excellent.